You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
For the 15th anniversary of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, we have a special guest, Richard Bay of The Richard Bay Show. You know him, and I am very proud that he is a listener to the show and a fan of the show. Richard Bay, welcome.
Not only a listener and a fan, but an early listener and fan.
That's true.
I don't know if I've been listening for 15 years, but I've been listening for at least 10.
Well, it does. You can shave 1 year off because nobody listened the first year. It's just me. No, I am happy to have you. And you know how radio is. You have vast experience. Sometimes you're like, I think there's this movie where Wolfman Jack is out there in the desert just, you know, talking into a microphone. And sometimes with podcasting, you know, if you're not doing something like this that we're doing over Skype, it can be very antisocial, and you wonder if anybody's listening at all. Like, you know,
I think that movie was American Graffiti.
That's it. Yes.
One of my favorites. Yeah. All right. So what are we going to talk about? History or politics or both?
Well, let's talk about both. I mean, a lot of people will know you, but for a few that don't, we'll just maybe a little bit about you did for a long time, The Richard Bay Show.
But I also had a long career on television. I started in 81 at CBS. I did a show called Two on the Town, where I had a female co-host, and we did all sort of New York fantasy things. I went to training camp with Bucky Dent. I sang at the Ritz with Gary U.S. Bonds, and we went to the most expensive studio apartments in Manhattan. And then I did People Are Talking, which was an hour-long live talk show in Philly. I replaced Maury Povich in Philly, and I was there for 4 years. I loved Philly. I loved the time I spent there. And then I came to New York, and I did a show called People Are Talking Here. And People Are Talking, in both iterations, was really a local Donahue kind of show. We did celebrity interviews. We did relationships. We did some, you know, fun contests and stuff. We interviewed some of the, you know, in fact, Jackie Mason, who just passed recently, we did an hour-long interview with him and Joan Rivers and Jimmy Carter and Steven Spielberg. And if it was in the front page of the Daily Tabloid, I had the greatest producers. They would get the guests that morning. The Central Park Five, the mother and some of the other people and the people that were against them, we had them on the show when that story was evolving. And I have to say, at the time, I was naive enough to think, oh, they confessed, you know?
Yeah, they probably did it. Everyone says they did it, and they we thought in different ways then. I mean, you were right in the middle of that kind of creation of talk show, the talk show as we know it, the audience and the microphone and the kind
Well, actually, that kind of talk show has died out. The serious kind of topical talk show. Mm-hmm. I mean, The People Are Talking I did in New York was the best show that I did out of anything, because I had great producers. Rosemary Henry was the executive producer, and man, when I walked into the studio, sometimes I didn't even know who the guest was going to be. And somebody would come in and say, here's the article, and you're on in half an hour. And I'd look at it, and I'd go, all right, shot on 34th Street by a 9mm, police arrived, two dead. And I'd go out, no teleprompter, and I have a pretty good brain for imprinting. And we just were winging it, you know?
One of the biggest issues now that really, it always was kind of around, but now it's got a name. And you hear so much about cancel culture as if the only time people who had an audience lost that audience because of some type of outrage. You know, it's only started, I guess, in 2020, 2021, right? It never existed before.
Well, that's, of course, BS, to not use the full word. We've always had some degree of, as Bill Maher knew when he was canceled for saying something after 9/11. And my last TV show went off the air the day after I had Jennifer Flowers on before Bill Clinton was running for president. And then I was on WABC radio every day pointing out the fallacious nature of the WMD evidence and the nuclear bomb that Sodom was making. It was so knowable. People said, oh, everybody thought he had it. No, everybody didn't think he had it. And it was demonstrable. You cannot prove a negative. You can't prove, oh, he doesn't have it. That thing was such a bamboozle. All right, so you want to stay with cancel culture.
But that got you canceled on, what was that? That was WABC in New York?
ABC radio. They got rid of everybody.
So you've actually gotten... You've actually gotten canceled for doing something maybe Clinton's didn't like, and then you got canceled for doing something the Bushes didn't like.
You know, I'm not important enough to think that Bill Clinton woke up and said, what the hell is this guy doing on TV? You know, but, you know, the media is monitored by the FCC and the FTC and, you know, they were in the process of selling Channel 9. And when it came to WABC, they fired every person that was against the war. They even, Lynn Samuels, me, Byron Schaefer was a minister who was on Religion Online between a hawkish rabbi and a hawkish priest. And they fired him. He was the one peacenik on ABC on Religion Online. And Ron Kuby and Curtis Sliwa, of course, were on opposite ends. But every time Ron Kuby would say this is ridiculous and try to point something out, he'd be sent home. Curtis would stay on the show, and Ron Kuby would be sent home. Sean Hannity would say, Richard, we're going to find so much WMD it makes your head swim. Well, today... He's making $25 million a year, and I'm collecting a pension.
Well, we're still glad to have you on, though. I'd rather have you on. Right. I get a little into the politics, especially at that time. And when we were talking earlier, you referenced the Dixie Chicks in this context. And I find it such a crime. I mean, look at the layers of this, for instance. So the lead singer of the Dixie Chicks says something like, I'm embarrassed to be... in America because Bush is president.
No, I'm embarrassed to be from the state of Texas where George...
That's what she says. Okay.
That's what she said. Not America, but Texas.
And this is a comment that I guess that was 2003 or 4. By the time you reach even the tail end of his presidency, 2007, really after Katrina, you could have found any number of people saying that. Even some country singers were saying how disappointed they were after Katrina. And then by the time you get to when I really fast forward and you get to Trump running in 2016 in the primaries in particular and attacking Jeb Bush, it was all about what a mistake to go into Iraq. And it's incredible where we've come, where there were, you know, breaking records and taking really did. They never had a record that sold as well as the previous one.
Yeah. And even though they made sort of a comeback, it was never the same. And isn't it ironic that the same people railing about cancel culture were the ones telling their listeners to smash Dixie Chicks records? Now, well, I was on the radio at the time and I shared the studio with Sean Hannity. He was on right before me. So I brought in Bruce Willis videotapes and I took a hammer and I said, Bruce Willis wants us to go to war based on faulty evidence. I'm smashing Bruce Willis movies live on the air. And I'd go, come on, folks, isn't that ridiculous? You know, I like Bruce Willis movies, you know, and, you know.
I think that there is, like you say, I agree, there was likely available evidence at the time of what direction to take. I think that, you know, Colin Powell goes into the Senate and I don't know what he tells him. There's rumors that he told him he has a nuke, and that scared a lot of the more war hawky Democrats. Say, but it seems to me there was available evidence it didn't need to even come out a few years later that something different from war needed to happen. And I think what to me there's a couple of things. One is the contrast between here and Britain, and in Britain. it's a decided matter, whether you're in the Conservative Party or whether you're in the Labor Party or what have you. Everyone just realizes Iraq War is the bad part of their history where Tony Blair made a mistake.
Right.
Here, it really is a middling thing. It reached very low approval levels towards the end there. But what I think you lacked is there was never, I guess it was just decided for convenience, there was never a thorough congressional investigation, official investigation of everything, and putting everything on the table and interviewing people, and whether that had to lead to an impeachment or not. I understand, you know, there's always pressure to win that election. They probably wanted to win in 08.
But it's also American amnesia about the embarrassing or actually dangerous parts of our history. It's the same thing people are saying about slavery now. You know, I mean, you have a congressman on the floor in the House, and he goes, "How come we never hear about the good things about slavery?" You know,
good Lord,
I mean,
yeah.
And people saying, "Oh, you know, we have this whole thing about critical race theory, which isn't even taught in the lower schools." And yet, then you have people saying, "Oh, everything, the Alamo." Some guys wrote a new book about the Alamo, telling the factual information. In fact, you should get them on your podcast because
I've been meaning to look up.
It's called "Forget the Alamo."
Mm-hmm.
What he posits is that a lot of this had to do with slavery. Now, I do not buy the 1619 project that the Revolutionary War was fought over slavery. I think that's pretty thin.
Hard to sell that when New England was the
right
center, and in about 10 years,
abolitionism,
Massachusetts would ban slavery in 10 years. I don't. It's hard for me to buy it when the big. But I do understand that obviously, if you're looking at the Southern states participating in the revolution.
But in Texas, Mexico had banned slavery.
This is true, right?
And Santa Anna wanted to ban slavery in Texas as a province of Mexico, and some of these people who were Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie and Travis, they were all pretty shady characters. They weren't coming there motivated by freedom. They were coming there motivated by hoping to grab some land and some riches.
Of course, my I don't know to call it spidey sense or whatever, but my little thing in my head says, well, there is a degree of that is the American way, is it not? You know, there's this mix of you go west because you do want to acquire something. But a couple of things there that I can note. One is, you know, reading a history about Texas's giant book. I wish I had it here. Big Wonderful Thing, it's called. Amazing. Huge book about the history of Texas. First of all, the Alamo's really big. Like, if you look at the Disney movies or whatever, you know, it's this, like, tiny little thing. I mean, Alamo was a huge place that they had to defend.
I've been there a couple of times.
Yeah, well, that all you're seeing is the one little mission that wasn't the whole Alamo then. I've been there as well. That's just the standing, the piece that's standing. But it was a huge and impossible to defend. At that point, it wasn't clear if the entire independence movement was going to happen yet. It happens after that. To some extent, I don't want to say it's manufactured. That was a real battle. They were really fighting and things like that. But it was a group that was told maybe you ought to come inward more and didn't. And there's all these things going on that's interesting outside of the politics of it. To the politics of it, 1844 election, Jackson is influential as an ex-president in determining the politics of the Democratic Party, his party. So an ex-president influencing a party. Interesting thing. In that he handpicked James K. Polk versus his own VP, Martin Van Buren, who he was disappointed with. And one of the things among many, he just didn't like the British. I mean, Jackson did not like the British.
Well, he fought them.
He fought them, and he was treated badly as a teenager and things like that. And he didn't trust them. He wasn't particularly great on the French either. He would get into a whole thing where he'd demand money and get it from the French during his presidency. And Sam Houston was saying, "Hey, I'm gonna move soon." Texas very well could have either stayed a country, but particularly stayed a country aligned, not really part of the empire or the Britain, but aligned with Britain for its existence. And that could have been a real viable thing. Didn't have to become an American state. And Sam Houston was leading. Sam Houston desperately wanted it to be a U.S. state. But his opponents in Texas, the other party in the Republican of the Republic of Texas, particularly President Anson, it was the big one behind that, wanted either England, France, or both. And there were English and French. There's still to this day in Austin a French, you wouldn't call it a consulate, that goes all the way back to when it was this tiny little town, and they were building a country, and it basically went to Jackson and said, if we don't get a state here, we're going to go with these other countries. Jackson didn't want, because if Britain got Texas or influenced Texas, they probably also would have worked with Mexico to end slavery there. Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas by Stephen Harrigan. It is a big, wonderful book. I can't read the whole thing, but I have read bits of part of it. And one that really got my attention is the relationship between the early Republic of Texas and France, and a little story. You start with a little scuffle that happens between France and Mexico, and that's in 1838. And it starts with a pastry shop in Mexico City, owned by a Frenchman, that is destroyed when there are riots in the street, an insurrection that occurs in Mexico, which was just common during the early part of this country's history. The French have claims, and there's bargaining back and forth between diplomats. Eventually, the French say, it goes from like one pastry shop to you owe us 600,000 pesos. I haven't done the calculation, but I'm sure it's a lot of money in this time. Mexico says, absolutely not. A French fleet comes and bombs Veracruz. Who fights it off? A young general leads the counterattack. His name's Santa Anna. He's shot off his horse by a French cannon, shatters his leg, and he becomes a hero in the country. And just before, he was a national disgrace, because he had tried to put down a rebellion in the what was then the northern part of Mexico, Tejas, and he was captured, forced to sign a document proclaiming their independence, and eventually released with American help. Now he's a hero again. Well, the Republic of Texas is not that old at this time, but they are seeking other countries that they can do business with, and one of them is France. Imperial France, at this time, they push for recognition. It is granted pretty quickly. France recognizes the new Republic of Texas, and they negotiate a treaty where they're going to accept Texas cotton at a certain tariff rate, and Texas is going to accept French silks, French wine. They send over a diplomat, Alphonse Dubois de Salgene. He comes with money, very good, and he builds this beautiful legation building in Austin, Texas, which is the new capital. The capital had been Washington on the Brazos, where independence is first declared. But now, after their hero Stephen Austin, they're declaring the new capital Austin, Texas. But not unlike our own capital when it began. It's a muddy group of wooden houses. The president's house, they make it with this new green wood that's so terrible that the house is actually shrinking, and President Sam Houston cannot stay there. He has to stay in a boarding house. I mean, it's a, so this French legation building is going to be one of the more beautiful structures in the new city. People are excited about it. But Dubois, while this is being constructed, has to take residence in a rented house. He likes gardening. He likes to have certain vegetables in his food, and he likes them fresh. So he has a garden. He has servants. He has nice linens in his home. It's well decorated. And next to him is a hog farmer named Richard Bullock. Well, he doesn't have much control of his hogs, and the hogs scrape through the Frenchman's fence, and they get to his vegetables and start eating them. This makes Dubois mad. But it's not just that. Eventually they break in again, And after the hogs are done with the vegetables, they go after his nice bed linens and start eating that. Then they start eating even some papers, important papers of state. He's mad. And he tells his servant, the next time you see those hogs, kill them. The hogs come in, and the servant shoots them. Richard Bullock is mad. And he sees the servant who did it on the street and beats him with a walking stick. This is outrageous, Dubois says. It's a violation of the League of Nations. This starts what the papers call the Pig War. In terms of Texas papers, they side with Bullock. Viva la pigs, one headline says. Go it, Texas, reads another. There's no war. There's no actual shooting. But Dubois does not become a very cooperative diplomat. And when French papers see the accounts of what's going on in Texas and how their diplomat was treated, there's no support anymore for much to do with Texas. And, you know, what was on the table was a $5 million loan that could have greatly enhanced the new republic. Sam Houston wasn't always president of the Republic of Texas. Actually, had four presidents. One of them was Mirabeau Lamar. Lamar really wanted to reach out to other countries and keep Texas independent. The backing of France might have been helpful. He was certainly seeking Britain's acceptance and recognition, and even the help of these countries, because they were having a heck of a time dealing with Mexico. In fact, there's going to be an invasion of Mexico that happens in 1840, an invasion by Mexico of Texas, which they never recognized officially in 1842. And they're going to capture San Antonio briefly, going to have some skirmishes back and forth. Texans under Sam Houston orders an invasion of Mexico then. It's very brief, just across the Rio Grande River. And there's going to be a lot of fighting back and forth, various people captured and killed. There's going to be fighting out west between Mexico and Texas over the New Mexico territory. And because of the incidents, you know, maybe you didn't have the type of support that they needed from at least one major European power that may have made it unnecessary for Texas to become a state. The French legation was eventually built in Austin, and it remains there today. You can go visit it if you're in Austin. They have various events there. They try to promote understanding between Texans and France. And they have even classes and other events.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Get those guys on the podcast because they're really great. They're very detailed, and they have the research. But in America, we love our myths. Every country does, doesn't it? You know, I mean, storm the Bastille, you know, Britons never, never, never will be slaves. Trafalgar, the defeat of Napoleon, the defense of Western. I mean, every country has its myths that it lives by. But we're living in an age, too, where not only the myths are being, or the statues, too, are being torn down, but it's the very idea that there is truth. And Trump really poured gasoline on this. I mean, you can tell people that the vaccines could save your life, and they'll tell you, no, it's a microchip developed by Fauci in in partnership with Bill Gates. You know, he could say one thing one day and then the next day say, I never said that. And
I think that it was always going on, too. Look, you remember, there was always any post office in America or any kind of during election season reaching voters, and you would see the Lyndon LaRouche table.
Oh, right.
And I always thought, my God, some guy is actually spending their afternoon doing this. But, you know, I feel like they never reached much purchase. And, you know, right. On the left, you'd probably have the one of the many communist or socialist party. But
now it's an entire party.
Yeah, I think that the social media is what did it. Like, social media is reinforcing and gives people that reinforcement they need if they're seeing, you know, hey, yeah, this could be true. Or like you said earlier, like, you can't say it's not. You can't prove a negative.
Yeah, you don't know it for
are
a
you,
fact.
And then you have to be a super scientist to, like, well, no, I don't happen to be a microbiologist. They're kind of hard to find. But I know, then you're talking medical without, I think, like...
I know, but for you know what, it goes back to me again to the whole Iraq war thing, where, who was it, Ron Siskind or somebody in the White House? He was told, you're in the reality-based community. And that's while right. you're sitting there trying to figure out what's happening in reality, we're creating reality a step ahead of you so you can study us, meaning that it's the action that takes place that will create the reality that you're studying.
Yes,
right?
And you'll be catching up. I still wonder, what do you think on that? Is that Rove or is that Rumsfeld?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'd always heard it was Rove, but...
Sounds like Rove, but...
But I don't know. But that was the time when I went, oh my God. And then you saw all these people, even after we went to Iraq and we found nothing, which was, you know, what I was saying, there was no evidence to find anything. But I remember I had Neil Cavuto on a radio show on Sirius, and he said, oh, we'll find something. Oh, we're still looking. You know, it could be buried. Remember we found those MiGs that were buried in the sand? He's probably got it buried in the sand somewhere. But it was like a madness. And even a year later, you had Sean Hannity saying, oh, we found it. Meaning what they found were caches of mustard gas that the UN had gathered and marked and sealed because we knew that he had mustard gas at one time, but it was old rusty canisters of mustard gas. And then he said, oh, we found the WMD. We go to war for mustard gas? And then they said, oh, it's in the back of Valley. Oh, well, I saw them. They were moving it on trucks into the back of Valley. But nobody ever goes back and says, yeah, even with Trump, Trump says, oh, I was against the war. He's a public figure. He's well reported upon. There is not one iota of evidence of him saying either before the war or in the first few months that he was against it. Perhaps maybe a year later or so, or, you know, or longer.
It reached 50-50 in Gallup polls, the war. Do you support the war? Right as Kerry was taking the stage in Boston in 2004. That's when it ebbed. Yeah, I mean, no, I totally see what you're saying. And the real tragedy is, even within a war context, not only was it a tragic war in many ways, but it pulled from another, we were already at war. And I know, I mean, what I've read, that Tommy Franks, the general at the time, was like, are you kidding me? You know, and then actually they went to do Iraq right after 9/11, and then somebody, maybe it was even Bush at that point, was like, no, we're not going to do it yet, but didn't take long.
I know, but they pulled all their focus from Afghanistan, where if they had initially really stayed in Afghanistan in the beginning and really subdued the Taliban and the countryside, if we had put our attention, we spent $1 trillion in Iraq, you know, and if anything, Iraq was a buffer against the Ayatollah in Iran, you know?
I think that's true.
I mean, I kept saying on the radio, I said, you get rid of Saddam Hussein, hey, you know who's going to be cheering us on? The Ayatollah. And the prime minister of Iraq The first official visit outside the country was he went to Iran and laid a wreath on the Ayatollah Khomeini's grave. And you had Bush going, Sunnis and Shiites, what's the difference? I mean,
Huge difference. Huge. And I think so. You played those games. But, you know, the early successes in the 2001 campaign in Afghanistan, some of the special forces victories, we were winning in some cases with buckets full of money. We were winning with special forces going in there disguised and working with the Northern Alliance. And maybe you would have had to send troops, but you really converted the whole thing to a definite boots on the ground and probably not enough and probably not equipped. There's all those issues. Absolutely. Your prediction came true in a sense because the power vacuum was obviously filled by other folks.
Do you remember this name? Mullah Omar. You know?
Yes.
You remember he was one of the guys that we went in, you know, to capture and say he was responsible for giving Al-Qaeda the shelter in Iraq. Mullah Omar is still leading the Taliban. You know, he's still around?
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy, who the number two under Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri is his name. He's a doctor. He's still alive. I never heard of whatever happened to him. He was the number two guy in Al-Qaeda. Ali Zawahiri, you know,
I remember
all these names, you know. I mean, listen, you know what happened to me? I was willing to accept the fact that maybe Saddam Hussein, maybe he did have WMD. And he did at one time, we know, in Halabja, where he gassed the Kurds. He had chemical weapons then. But in that, remember Andy Card said, in the summertime of 2002, the Bush White House went silent. There was nothing about Iraq or Saddam. And Andy Card famously said, you don't sell new products in the summertime. You sell them in the fall. So wait a second. You had the atom bomb. Then you have Dick Cheney on Meet the Press saying that Mohammed Atta met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague. It didn't happen. Rumsfeld, later on in the month, says, we found in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish area, we found this terrorist group. The guy is still alive, too. He's in Norway or Sweden. Mullah Cracker. Anyway, this was a terrorist group that was trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
I think that, too, it's the 2002 midterm. Now, it's relevant definitely for history because there's the midterm 10 trend where a president loses seats from their own party in the House almost every time in their first term. And it's probably going to happen to Biden. I can't be a responsible political historian and not look at that trend and say, you're hanging on to the House by what is it, like 3, 4, or 5 seats or so, almost every year.
And not only that, the Republicans have the right to gerrymander the states where they control.
Pretty much in their control. A couple of governors that might, at best, like in Pennsylvania, might best veto something, but it's generally, going to be theirs to swing. 2002, you know, that should have been you generally would have seen in opposition seats, but there was such an attack on patriotism of politicians at the time.
Right.
Of course,
right.
Pushing the Patriot Act and the war authorization. I don't think anyone signing that or voting for that authorization knew how long it was going to be continuing to be used for. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot there. I just think, I know it's American amnesia too, but I also do think that what was missing that happened in other historical times is just a kind of more investigation and more.
Let me throw this in there. How does this country go from George Bush, who's a fairly, and I don't think he's an evil person, but I think he was callow, inexperienced, incurious, you know? He'd only been outside of the country once. Your father is the director of the CIA, has friends all over the world, and you don't want to travel to Europe and see the rest of the world or or go off
to... I think that up until, with Bush, by his own admission, really, up until he, 40 or what have you, you know, he's pretty much a...
Party boy.
Party boy, wasting time, president's son, and he, by his own admission, spent, you know...
It was the Dick Cheney White House.
I think like there's a mix there. I'm willing to go that there's a mix there. Like I don't want to go as far as the Saturday Night Live bit or whatever with Cheney in the beater shirt, but you know, it's like I think there was somewhat of a mix, but really you're talking about generally two people who wanted to go to the same place anyway. So it's almost a non.
All right, but wait. Let me get back to my point.
Yeah, go ahead.
How do we go from Bush to Obama to Trump? I mean, it's just, how does the same country elect those three different people? Now,
we're under a constitution, but we always act like a confederation. We're a patchwork country. We've always been. There's 50 states in a lot of cases that couldn't be more different from each other. With, you know, there's cities and urban. And so it's really, it is what it really is.
Schizophrenic.
One team has the most points in one game and the other team has the most points in the other game. And there's some switching. Like I know, like Obama, particularly in 2008, did very well in certain North Dakota counties that Democrats couldn't get votes from. But still, you know, but when you got to 2012, that was receding. But it's a patchwork country and, you know, at different times, yeah, there was more, you know, look, I mean, 2008, I think a thing to remember is that it was a lot to do with the economic crash. It's unclear to me.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, you probably would have seen an Obama victory, but McCain and Palin initially, Palin especially upon her launch, was a big boost in the polls for that ticket and put him up. And again, but when you had the economic crash, it was over, particularly how it was handled by the candidate. Like McCain just did not do a good job with that. Even Bush in his memoir.
But how did Romney lose to Obama?
Well, I think incumbents win unless there's the economy was on the rise. And I think generally in history, incumbents win unless there's a real reason for them not to. And the economy is a major reason, and it's the trend in the economy in addition to the currency of the economy, I believe. There was no challenge in the party to Obama the way that Carter was challenged by Kennedy. He had a solid party for him. You had enough. There was at least a signature achievement, if not really, if you look at Osama bin Laden and Obamacare, there were two things that you could say were right. Identifiable achievements. Now, I could be critical of Obama as well. I think that second term, I think it was just sitting around waiting for the next go round. Well, partially an answer to your question.
I know, but he lost Congress.
You know, I agree with that too. But even in pushing for things and pushing for legislation, I think it was a very modest effort in the second in the second term. And that's to me why partly of the reason why what happened in 2016 happened. It's not only, I think there's always been a bit of negative around Hillary Clinton in New York State in 2000. It was present, but she was able to overcome it. And nationally, I think it's still there in a lot of places. Just like some of it might be the attacks on her, some of it might be, look,
she's not built. Except that when she left the administration as Secretary of State, her approval rating was over 60%. But between that time and her candidacy,
the primaries were really
You had the Russians again, and I'm not a big Hillary Clinton, or I wasn't a big. I'm more of a fan now. You know what made me a Hillary Clinton fan, and I wasn't a big fan before this? Watching her sit in front of the House panel for 11 hours and take the tirades on Benghazi, which was another piece of BS, you know, that it was her fault, you know. I mean, if anybody's fault, you know, it's hard to say it, but, you know, the ambassador shouldn't have gone there. He shouldn't have gone there. It was his choice. He wanted to. He felt, and he was, and there was a general who asked him and said, do you want more security? He turned it down.
It doesn't seem to be an issue that normally is, while it's a tragic event, it doesn't seem to be an issue that normally we judge the entire performance of a Secretary of State on,
right,
or a presidency. Right. It sounds like it frankly sounded like a...
But you know what happened? It was the Benghazi hearings that led to the computer memos, which was the scandal that really, you know, helped to bring down her candidacy. There was something revealed in that they said, oh, my God, she has a server in her house. I mean, before that, nobody knew.
And I think that you see where you see there, I think, in the answer to the question, I think, first of all, I consider we're always looking at incumbent presidents in any election, even when the incumbent's not running. And I think that you're right. Deck of cards Obama got in the second term wasn't there, but it almost doesn't matter. Not a lot was accomplished. And it even got worse after 2014 when you lose the Senate as well. So not a lot accomplished there. So you got that. The economy was okay. Then you come to things like, is the party at one? Are they united? And Philadelphia 2016, maybe with some disguises that other conventions didn't get to have, some like hiding of it, and was one of the most disunited political conventions since 68, I think, or since, well, maybe 1980s.
Oh, it was terrible. And it was manipulated by the Russians, who dumped the emails, what is it, one day or 2 days before the election? I tell you this, the Washington Post had the story in June about how the Democrats were hacked, and I believe they pointed the finger at the Russians. I put up on Facebook, I said, this is going to be a bigger story. This has got to be out there. In June, I said it. And then in July, but they played the Bernie supporters who were Bernie or nothing.
That's definitely, I think, a major factor, right? You split the party. But there are two things. One I always get because I don't know enough to be able to prove things, especially when it gets into electronics and tracking and hacking and tracking who hacked, let's just say. I mean, is it really the Russians? I guess we have the intelligence agency saying that was. But someone hacked. The most beneficiary, right, could be Russians, because I know I always get that question when I say it. Someone hacked the Democrats, put it out there, and not only put it out there, but they put it out there with cliff notes. Like, by the way, here's the...
I know, that's the thing. And you know who does know is Julian Assange.
Right, right.
And we have him. You know,
a frequent guest on My History Can Beat Up Your Pop. No, I'm only kidding. But here's the thing, though, Richard. This is the thing that does come up, because I have some friends who are far more to the left than me, and they have a take on it. Russians, Assange, somebody in their basement, whoever hacked it. You can't take away my feelings. In other words, I read things that they said about Bernie Sanders, or things they were going to do to that campaign within the DNC, and you can't take that away. However, it was leaked.
Yeah. I read the emails, too. Go back to the source.
Yeah.
Just as I did with Iraq.
Right.
I read those emails. There was nothing in them that said this is a rigged primary system.
No, of course not. No.
There was nothing in there. But, as you said, the addendums that I believe were put in by Assange and his group, I put them in a different light to ignite people to say, oh, the worst thing that happened was what's her name? Who's the woman who was
Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
No, not her. The other one,
Donna Brazile.
Donna Brazile, right before the debate. Well, so listen, she did something, and it's wrong. It was just wrong. But she told Hillary Clinton, there's going to be a question about the death penalty. Now, do you think that's going to change the course of the debate? I mean, there were two questions. One was about that. I forget what the other one was. But they were questions that anybody should be able to answer off the top of your hat, top of your head, if you're in politics. It wasn't like, here's the cheat sheet. They're going to try to trick you up, so come up with an answer. But what Donna Brazile did was wrong. was wrong.
I just agree. I think on the Brazil and everything else, because I do think what ended up with the Podesta emails or the DNC hack was still in, let's just say, it plays into people's expectations that politics are pure out there. And we know that they're not pure. They're still good if they're not 100% everything's like perfect, like you learn in Schoolhouse Rock or something, you know. So I think people are shocked that there's gambling in Atlantic City, you know, when they hear these things. But unfortunately, if you're new to politics, which a lot of people were new to really being involved that year, you know, then you're seeing that at least there's an unfriendliness. Let's say some of those emails at least reflected like.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
You know, and my argument, of
course...
You're right! My argument would be that the DNC is not sitting there as a bunch of people with black and white stripes and a whistle. They are a party. The Republican Party's the same way.
And not only that, Hillary Clinton has been a Democratic candidate by that time for at least 16 years and a Democratic First Lady for 8 before that. Bernie Sanders wasn't even a Democrat before all this happened. These people have had experiences with Hillary. And yes, I'm sure underneath it all, they wanted Hillary to win. But there was nothing in terms of shenanigans against Bernie. All of the primary, first of all, those, what do they call it? Caucuses.
Caucuses, yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, that, to me, that's a completely ridiculous way to choose a candidate. You could walk over and say, get the hell over on my side or I'm going to punch you in the nose. I mean.
I go back to the, it's like with the Texas thing we were talking about earlier. There's a little bit of America in that. But no,
or
I think.
Or a girl coming over saying, hey, I'll go home with you tonight if you come over for Hillary or you come over for Bernie.
Hopefully it's a job in the weather research department, we hope. But,
But and they're all in a basketball court and they're all trying to get people to come from the other side. I mean, this isn't the Acropolis.
It's unfair to working people, too. They can't get there. They can't stay there all day. I say you keep it in Iowa. I think there's a tradition. There's Carlson's in Iowa. I'm not going to lie. I think it's a tradition there. You keep it in the one state. The rest of this, they got to figure something out that's fairer. But, you know, the primaries, at least, are run by the states. So to say that they're rigged is like, are you saying, so is the state of New Hampshire rigged? The state of, now, again, we were talking about truth before, because I think if it's helpful, eventually someone is going to start saying that, you know. Yes, I believe all the states were rigged, you know. And you saw a little bit of that in 2020. So it's,
we're saying it now. Yeah, Trump is saying it. Arizona was rigged and Georgia was rigged. And
it's hard to challenge any, you know, it's hard to use any logical bulwarks anymore, because even I say something like that, I know that it could be turned. But I guess to me, that's the point of when you talk about why there was a loss and why we switched between three different types of presidents in such a short period of time. I think it's mostly because of that, the split on the left, because you see some of the states and the very, in 2016, and the very low amount of votes that changed some of those states. And
all right,
the one agency that I point to, there's two things that I could point to that, and I'm speaking really not just as a person interested in the politics of this in 2016, but a little bit from history and what's worked in the past. And there's two things that strike me with 2016 that went wrong specifically for Democrats. And that is, VP pick, Tim Kaine.
Oh,
when your problem was on your progressive left and it was acknowledged and you're going to pick the governor of Virginia, state that all the population trends show that there's no catching up there for Republicans.
And not only that, he's innocuous.
Yeah, he wasn't good. I mean, Pence, I felt, beat him in the VP debate. It's just like, that's what you're going to do. Now, I'm not saying you pick Sanders, but what you have a problem, whether it was your fault or not. You get somebody in a room, you you make sure that Sanders is involved in that pick. I wouldn't pick, I really don't know. Maybe Clinton Sanders would have carried you in 2016 now that I look at the numbers.
Oh, man. You want to know something? Clinton Sanders, that would have been, but then the emails would have come out and it would have been, and it would have meant nothing, right?
Yeah, it's tough to say. I think, though, that at least, look, the historical part of it here.
Well, she could have picked Sherrod Brown,
yeah.
Who's got very strong, what? No, Sherrod
no,
Brown
no, no, I agree.
Strong,
I agree. Yeah.
He's more moderate than Bernie, but he's got very strong left-wing credentials.
Would have a chance at Ohio, which would have turned it. If you're winning Ohio, you're probably winning Pennsylvania, which is some of the point. But unified party is a key to history. Right. If someone challenges either Biden or Harris, whoever runs in 2024, and they do a good challenge, they will lose.
All right. I want to throw something else into the mix here and pick your brain on it.
Okay.
Now, I'm living in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Florida has 250,000 more registered Democratic voters than Republicans. Mm-hmm. Everybody looks at Florida and says, oh, it's a blood red state. DeSantis only won by 0.4% the governorship. And he was running against a guy who ended up in a room with cocaine and a gay hooker eventually. So maybe we didn't miss the bullet because DeSantis is awful. But then you have Rick Scott. So we have 250,000 more Democratic voters. Meanwhile, we have two Republican senators. We have a Republican governor. We have both houses of the legislature, and one of them by 2-1, overwhelmingly Republican. It just doesn't make any sense.
I think one team is winning the splits more often, and then those wins are helping the later wins. Once you have the governorship, that helps you with the other elections. I think Democrats, an investigation of some of those roles and interviewing some of those people might reveal that they voted for Truman, and that was the last Democrat. No,
maybe.
I encountered one of those in New Jersey once, so I always remember that as it's like, yeah, in 1948, I registered.
Well, that was my father. My father didn't vote for a Democrat after Truman. And then right before he died, he did vote for Kerry. I convinced him to vote for Kerry.
I mean, Kerry came darn near close. I mean, Kerry was one of the closest losing candidates. Usually the Electoral College in American history is a blowout either way. So you actually have in 2004 one of the closer ones. It's either going to go one way or the other big with the Electoral College. I mean, that's part of its design. But with the Florida question, there's a couple of things. While Florida has a lot of people coming from the Northeast, very many of them, maybe your Palm Beach, your 2000 crowd, but yourself, are bringing, let's say, New York values down there. But there is a substantial amount, and I think a lot in the latest contingent, that might be in that kind of Jacksonville or those parts, some of the new developments that are, right. They might very well be coming from New York State, New Jersey, Connecticut. But if you survey them and talk to them, they're getting away from high taxes. They're getting away from what they consider some city governments. Right or wrong, whatever they may not be realizing you got to fund schools and that's why the taxes are, this kind of thing. But it may not be, they may even have a D next to their name. I do believe the state's close. I just think if you're running a Republican campaign, you absolutely must win it. You will not win the presidency without Florida. Never. Has not.
Obama won it twice.
No. As a Republican. You cannot win.
But what I'm saying is Obama won it twice,
Yeah, no, you can't win as a Republican without Florida and your war chest.
Trump won it twice, So.
It's one that you're going to win if you're winning elsewhere anyway. You're winning Arizona, Georgia, whatever, and then Florida falls in because Biden-Harris did something that's so popular that they're winning the election anyway. Florida could be folded in. I just don't think it's a difference-maker state for Democrats. You have a lot of, I think Trump did very well in Miami-Dade in 2020, which was interesting. That was a whole...
That was Hispanics, the Cuban vote,
the Cuban
too,
vote,
right?
And
Venezuelans.
And yeah. Venezuelans, yeah, and other countries, so they're seeing kind of the... I don't know with that. I question that one. I think that could be something where you have to be in the White House to benefit from that. Because in the White House, there's a certain amount of foreign policy moves that you can make. They can no longer dangle things like that if they're not in the White House. So it's... That's what I say about Florida. You know, on the other hand, Ohio looks like I run the numbers, I run the counties. I can't see it. It would be very difficult. Maybe if they ran Sherrod Brown for the top of the ticket. Otherwise, I don't think Democrats winning Ohio.
Wasn't Ohio the bellwether state?
It was.
Wasn't there a time no candidate has ever won the presidency without Ohio?
Just right? JFK in 1960. That's it. And very close. That was another thing in 2016, early on. I was actually on this cast with this fellow Chris, and I was like, I keep hearing them saying, we're probably going to lose Ohio. Oh, you're just going to lose Ohio. I mean, it's a trend that something was going on.
Right.
The hacking and all this other stuff definitely was going on. I believe that there were some political factors on the ground. Heck, I think Bill Clinton was telling him, get over to Michigan, start hitting, you know.
Right.
This has been great talking to you, by the way, Richard.
Same here.
I appreciate it.
I always love talking. Yeah, it's so rare to find someone who knows more than me about
I don't know.
And who I can learn from. And you are it, you know. And
I tell people I'm like the plumber. And then, of course, someone told me on Twitter, please use a different metaphor. I said, no, I'm not talking about the really bad plumbing jobs. All right, just the pipes, all right? I'm like the plumber. I'm just working. Like, I see a political question, and I want to answer it. And I only know what I research.
But are we living in an era, this will be my final question to you.
Sure.
Are we living in an era where there's a new paradigm? I mean, everybody said, oh, Biden, it's a return to normalcy. Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't returned to normalcy. As much as he stands there and tries to reassure us that his friends are the Republicans and that we're all going to be fine and work together. And I know this country has gone, the 60s were a divisive time, and and both 60s,
mm-hmm.
the 18 and the 1960s.
Very true there. Yeah, you go to the 1860s, and everything is the same. Everything, to the point I found that they had a woke club. They had wide awake clubs.
Oh, that's right. They walked around with torches.
I mean, and then you had in the South, you didn't have similar groups, but no, they wanted to use chloroform and put the wide awakes to sleep. So it's like, you know, I mean, and then you had violence in the Capitol, you had fighting among Congress members,
oh,
Preston Books, and Charles.
Practically, he almost killed one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and not only that, people who tried to intervene were held back and threatened with violence. Like, so you see in that time, but okay, you're going back to the 1860s. So people could say, well, then it still is a very different time. I still believe that there's always been a lot of conflict. We're just kind of show me the time when the other side laid down, when the Democrats just let the Republicans win, or when the Republicans just let the Democrats win. All that's really different is that there's a little bit more parity between populations, and something must be going on with rural, urban, exurban, and political affinities.
So this era that we're living through is not some new American...
I just remember I remember being in Pennsylvania in 1988 and seeing this flyer in the Poconos that was posted to, I think we were getting ice cream or something. Because I was more interested in ice cream than politics then, and maybe I should have stayed with the ice cream, but put that aside. And there was this thing about, it showed Bush, and it had all this nice stuff about him, and Dukakis, and everything was the worst kind of evil conspiracy stuff. You could, things that he didn't say, and everything like that, and the Willie Horton, and all that. And it was posted with a piece of tape on paper. So perhaps to me, the technology has driven a lot of this. The intents were still there. Feelings were still there. There was an emotional attack, an emotional decision made in 1988, not a consideration of who was the greatest, the most graceful president that could be in the White House. So I think like some of it is there, but technologies bring more of that out. Technologies affect, for instance, the whole media. They're all going to Twitter to get their stuff. So Obviously, they see someone putting things out on a regular basis in Twitter. It affects the coverage. Coverage can be challenged now in a way that in the TV era, maybe it wasn't as easy. There weren't as many voices. New things are going to happen, or new ways of doing. Look at the 2000 election and the way that the recount was run in Florida, how that one vote was stopped in Miami Vale. Like, I think you see either that was the beginnings of something where you kind of had this, or was it always there, just not always visible?
I've always seen the link between that and January 6th. Except that the Brooks Brothers riot to halt the vote counting, and then it was Brooks Brothers. They were all...
And some of them were staffers. Many of them were staffers. Congratulations.
Yeah, and they were all suit and tie guys. If you had not seen that poster and you said you should have been more interested in ice cream, you would be running a podcast. My pistachio can beat your rocky road. and the world would be so different. I think it's just always a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on 15 years. But I always learn something. You know, and there are times I go, oh my God, I thought I knew this backwards and forwards. But
well, Richard, I'm honored to have you say that, and I really do appreciate your listening to the show, and it's a big morale booster for me to have you on.
Oh, well, it was my pleasure, totally my pleasure.